The ticker's going up. Welcome, Lewis. You're the second guest on the Interconnects podcast. I think it's an interesting one for me because everyone kind of points to me now as the person that is in the face of RLHF, and I get a lot of questions. And to me, Lewis has represented that person. I think Lewis provided most of the information on the first RLHF blog post that I wrote for Hugging Face back in the day. If there's somebody that I want to ask questions about RLHF, it generally goes to him. So now you all are going to know this in the open. We're going to cover a lot of things. As always, I'm trying to talk with researchers on the ground and people actually doing things in these topics. I think we're going to cover a lot of things today. We're in the Latent Space podcast. If you're watching on video, you may have noticed that. We're the Latent Space studio. And they reminded us we've got to start off with covering the Gemini news and what that means for RLHF. And then most of this is a long docket of the core questions facing the two of us as we're trying to make RLHF more open, more useful, not only about safety, but safety is important to it and important to us. So I think we can kind of get going. I think the first question that I have is just get rolling. What is your favorite Rhode Island fact?
My favorite Rhode Island fact? Oh, man. All the H.P. Lovecraft stuff. Like, I walking around Providence with, like, friends who like H.P. Lovecraft and be like, oh, yeah, you know, this was, like, that building in Call of Cthulhu or, like and that was always...
Wow, I didn't even know this. I mean, for the record, I grew up in Rhode Island, if people didn't know. And then that's where Lewis spends most of his time these days.
Providence.
So we'll come back to this. I think I'm just going to start with kind of the hardest question, and it'll get easier for us from here. It's like, what was your first reaction when you saw all of this Gemini stuff?
The the adding custom like races and demographics to like image prompts component, right?
Yeah.
So DALL-E had done that back when DALL-E 2 first came out and was like in beta, and people were reporting like a person holding a sign that says X, and then the sign would say black, or the sign would say white, or the sign would say Asian. And it was a very hacky solution then, and I thought a lot about it then as well, and I almost felt like, you know, it gets you 90% there for like 1% of the time of the way of like doing this, like you know, like in a more proper and auditable way of like making sure your training data has like equal representation, or making sure your RLHF data has good representation. And you know, you can't do those things after the fact, but what you can do after the fact is like inject things into the prompt to make it more controllable. And it really comes down to the fact that controllability right now is not a solved problem, and most of our solutions to controllability are a little bit hacky.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think to summarize for people, this has been an ongoing issue when we're recording on the 27th here. Gemini initially got flack for like actually forcing diversity into historical scenes, and then it started getting more flack for flat out refusing certain requests on race. Like all of this stuff is just like, it's like, ouch to somebody like I know people working on this stuff, and it's just like the way that it ends up here is not like what a lot of people think. Like the Gemini team is obviously moving fast, and it seems to me that the image stuff has always been like a red herring. That's the way that Swix phrased it as well, is like somehow they got to the point where a prompt was shipped in this final solution for the image editing. And that's just hard. It's just like, obviously there was a big goof up there, but then it's like, we're looking at examples, and still today, like Meta's image generator, so on like WhatsApp or whatever, you can ask an AI that it'll have similar issues where it forces diversity into a question with multiple people. Microsoft Copilot has this. It's like the text thing, and really digging into how we think these big companies could be adding like forcing this into their data. Or like, we know that there's a lot of uncertainty over how all of these companies get their preference data. Some of them work with companies like Scale and Surge, some of them do it in-house. Who is providing it isn't really an issue, because they're probably giving similar instructions and similar workforces across the board. But it's like, how do we see this entering the preference data that they're adding to RLHF? Because it's like, if you look at a base model, Like, we were just working with Olmo, and it's like, if you ask a base model, you say like hello to a base model. A lot of times the base model will then go off and be like some crazy like 4chan shit, because like so many of the conversations on there, even with good data processing techniques, is like from weird corners of the internet. So like I don't see any base model that comes out with some like de-biased thing. So it's added on is my thing. And it's like, how did we end up there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, when I was saying, this is something that they do like retroactively once they've acknowledged that these issues exist in the data set, once the model has been trained, it's not something that can be easily fixed even if they had infinite resources. Like, it's very, very hard to go back and actually rectify these biases in a way that's like equitable to like all the kinds of preferences that someone might have when wanting to interact with this model, right? There's the fact that, at least as far as I know, until recently, DALL-E did this as well, where you could still say a person holding a sign that says X and it would still say black, white, or whatever. And the amount of resources that they're pumping into making sure that, you know, they're building a consumer product. They're building like the main consumer product in the space. The amount of resources that they've been pumping into it, and this still presents a large issue for them, just shows how difficult this like really is.
Yeah. And another example that people on the, like, I have this Discord that's growing for paid and friends, or paid subscribers and friend. And someone pointed out this work where if you ask DALL-E to generate like a doctor and an assistant, like all the same bias problems still show up. So like a lot of the solutions that we have are not necessarily like deep and at this like conceptual level. It's at this like, you tell your preference labelers to do a certain thing and then they do it, but you may not have good tracking of like which data point is responsible for these different things.
Yeah, you know, interpretability for like preference learning in general, it's we're very, very far from actually understanding like what preferences result in what model behaviors and like, you know, preferences that disagree with
like
each other.
John Shulman talk.
Yeah,
it's absolutely. Like that was his whole talk, and it was great just to have him get up there and be like, "This is so hard."
Yeah, and like, I've done like a ton of experiments myself where I just like have an RLHF data set and I like randomly remove 10% and I have like a bunch of models, each with like a different 10% removed. And I'm like, well, what behavioral differences can I see between these models? And then not only is it like, you can see differences, but it's extremely hard to quantify. It's extremely hard to actually understand what the difference is. And then like, there's almost no way to know what in that 10% caused that difference.
Yeah, like, this reminds me of like the Hugging Face No Robots data set, which is like a professionally curated instruction data set. Mm-hmm. Whenever we added that to a model, it was like, this is obviously our most valuable data, but it would show up on zero benchmarks. And we were like, well, what do we do? Yeah. And it's like, we're talking about Google's problems here, and we'll get back to like the data problems in the open source. And it's like, they probably have order of millions of data points that are going into this preference data. And some of it is, for some proportion, it's probably about safety. I think we could talk about like the Anthropic HH data, which like the people don't actually know the details of it, because it's like a quarter of it is like helpful data, or then three quarters is, or like a quarter is harmless and three quarters is helpful from different rollouts. And it's like, these are very specific things. It's like huge data problems that most people aren't really thinking about.
Yeah, most people are just like blindly, oh, well, this is safety, so I'm going to throw it into my data set and hopefully like it works and hopefully like we get good behavior. But I don't really know what's in this data set. I haven't really looked at the data. And that's something that I've heard many, many times over the last year of people like trying to get their feet wet in the RLHF space.
Yeah, and do you have any intuitions? This is like the last point of the Gemini thing. I'm like, if we don't think that like the image generation of Gemini is the biggest issue, I think it's like in the text and how this preference data is collected. But like, do you have anyone that is doing multimodal RLHF? Because I generally think that it's like, we don't know how to do this at all, which is like how you control input. If you have multiple inputs and multiple outputs, is like, how do you control your modality distribution and data count and stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have two friends of mine who have been doing like video RLHF for a little while now, I guess a little bit over a year. And you know, they like condition their video model on some text encoder, and they've been talking about like having to do RLHF independently for both the text encoder and the video model, but like video RLHF is just like massively underdiscovered and no one really knows what they're doing in that space. And
when you say independently, what do you mean? Like before making the video model, are they like RLHFing the text backbone or are they freezing the rest of the model?
Yeah, they're RLHFing the text backbone. I think there was actually a paper from Tencent last August that basically did the same thing for like multimodal RLHF where they had to RLHF the text backbone and then the RLHF, like the image generation components on top of that.
Does that look like that's the... Like they, you, this is potentially basic, but like to train a visual language model, you have to have some link. You have to add some like type of a mechanism that links the gradients between the two. And sometimes you start with a, most of the time, I think these days they're starting with this language backbone and they're adding on vision and continuing to train. Mm-hmm. And then this is like at the end of this where you have a visual language model, then they're freezing the gradients of the video part and then RLHFing the text part. Or is this like before the text backbone is even initialized on the model?
The space is a little too early.
I think that's the point. It's like we don't know these links.
Like, but I know people in the last like 8 months who have done it the way of like before they even add the image component, they RLHF the text model, and then they add the image component and then the RLHF image.
Yeah. So this is really interesting. Like I'd be interested from like a everyone talks about how RLHF is low computation and flops compared to what people are doing. Mm-hmm. Like in the open, we say that it's like 50 or 100,000 training samples. Mm-hmm. Llama 2 is like 1.5 million. I'm guessing the closed models like Gemini are probably another 10 million like or higher. Like they're much bigger. And it's like, is the amount of video training that it takes to train this backbone after the fact like is still helping? Like does that undo some of the text RLHF or does it not? If the answer is, I don't know. But these are the kind of things that I want to have people start talking about. It's like, is RLHF becoming like a sequential process as you add modalities, or can you wait all to the end and like do just multimodal RLHF? We don't know these things. And this is what people in Gemini are starting to work on.
I definitely, I've spoken to a lot of people who are like, or at least thinking in this space. I've only spoken to a small number of people who are actually working in this space. But for the people who are thinking in this space, really the dream is to be able to express preferences in modalities where it's beneficial to express preferences in those modalities. Like, it doesn't make sense to express preferences over code as like images or video, but it does make sense to express preferences over like puppies as like photos.
This is a great point. And I think the thing is like, where you ended your sentence is like, make preferences over puppies. It's like, we don't know what people use visual outputs for in like a productive sense and really inputs. Like the things are like, analyze this video. Like that's a toy example where like analysis creating RLHF pairs, I think actually is not too hard for us. Like it takes a lot of effort because a human has to know what is in the video to do like a summarization RLHF. Like if you're passing in a 3-hour video into Gemini base model and then it outputs two outputs, like the human's not going to know what's right unless it has context of what the video is. And that is just way different than like a poem where you could read both of them.
Yeah. So there's actually a really fascinating paper from OpenAI that I really haven't seen anyone build on. It was the idea of like summarizing really long books and you doing RLHF to do that.
Is
and
this like, the like recursive summarization?
Yeah, one? Yeah. It's the recursive summarization. It's the idea that like you can almost treat like long summarizations as like a weird RLHF, like almost like merge operation where like you divide, and then eventually you get to segments where it makes sense to collect annotations. And then on those segments, you have a human annotator go through and say, oh, this segment is better than this segment, or the summary of this segment plus this segment is this. And then when you combine summaries, now you can say, well, this summary plus this summary gets you this summary. And eventually you get preferences going all the way up the tree and you get a preference of the whole book at the end. And obviously, you know, it's a crude approximation of what the summary of the whole book is, but it's much more feasible than asking human annotators just to summarize an entire book.
Yeah, I mean, I just realized this on the pod right now. It's like how ridiculous RLHFing like an entire code base in context is. And like that's like where some of the like opportunities for what I think RLHF could do, which is like just synthetic data labels and stuff. It's like, we can create synthetic preferences in many different ways that aren't all reliant on like this kind of human subjectivity.
Yeah, it's like, it's a deeply fascinating problem actually going into like, how big is Gemini's context window, the 1.5 thing? It's like 10 million
it's,
tokens.
Yeah, it's shipped with 1 million and they have experiments in the paper up to 10 million.
Like, who really wants to use a 10 million token context window And like, how accurately do you really, can you really think about preferences over the range of a 10 million token context?
I think people want to use it, but I think the preference thing is a lot harder.
Yeah.
Because it's like, I could have, this is something I encounter in Hugging Face regularly. It's like, Hugging Face is a popular code base. You expect the code models to do well, but they still don't do well. Like they don't know, like, they'll make up data sets functions or something. And like, if you just have all of Hugging Face's code in context when you're like working in the Hugging Face ecosystem, like that'll make you so much better.
Mm-hmm.
And like, or analyzing long videos and stuff. Like, I do think there's a lot of use cases. And I
could, yeah.
But like, the preference thing is just a totally different framing.
What do you think about the needle in the haystack evaluation that they did?
I haven't read a lot about it, but I think essentially what it's there's like a difference between being able to act on the information and being able to like retrieve it. And I think it's like, these models should be passing needle in the haystack because that shows that they're like actually like noticing that the information is there, but that does not necessarily mean that they're going to like be able to synthesize all the information in a compelling way.
Yeah.
So it's like a pass, it's like a pass bar, which is like you need to have this to be credible in long context. But I think that actually evaluating long context and like what behaviors we want to see is pretty open-ended.
I think you have, I don't remember his last name.
Like Goldberg?
Yeah, Goldberg. Yeah. He put out a paper like yesterday where he's like, oh, needle in the haystack is interesting, but if you have like more than two needles, like it's entirely uncorrelated with the single needle in the haystack benchmark.
Yeah, because it's like trying to find one thing at each part of the context. It like breaks the context window into many segments, and then it's making sure that you can find something in each of those segments.
So it's almost like, I feel like we're almost going to get to the point where like the attention itself is the limiting factor, because the model genuinely just cannot equitably like split attention over its context window to retrieve as many things as it realistically needs in order to produce something.
Do you think that RLHF could manipulate long context behavior more than people might expect? Because it's just like an open question.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting open question. And if the answer turns out to be yes, in context, RLHF becomes like absolutely massive, because like right now, like it can kind of sort of work, but like not really. And like every benchmark I've ever seen for in context RLHF almost isn't charitable at all to the RLHF baseline. And it's not like, from the experiments that I've done and the experiments that people in Eleuther have done, it's comparable on like very niche situations, but it's not comparable in general, because you still have all the issues with in context learning where like you'll massively overfit on the preferences that are like put in the beginning of the context versus preferences that are like put
in the end. Let's try to explain what this in context RL is actually doing. So is it running, like everyone, a lot of people know what an RL algorithm is, and in context learning is designing a prompt. Like, is it training a model to generate prompts? Like, what are you actually RL using the RL update, and like what are the parameter, what are you parameterizing when you're doing in context RL?
So I mean, there's a number of different approaches for in context RL. There is the
could be part of the problem. It's like people do a lot of different things, but like what are some of them?
So the one that I was referring to is I think the Yejin Choi paper.
Yeah, it's like Uriel.
Yeah, where like she's like, she's just prompted chatbot, you are interacting with the user, here's what their preferences are, like have at it. But there's also stuff like that, like Misha and DeepMind.
This is the first one that I think of.
Yeah, where it's like you have some agent that's interacting with an environment, and you store all of these state action pairs, and you just like fine tune models on like episodes of these state action pairs. And then the idea is that like if you just put enough episodes into a context window, on the next episode, it'll just perform better, right? And it's like the algorithm distillation paper, and you can like use this to like distill stuff like, I think the actual example that Chris Liu's paper does, where they do like algorithm distillation on S4, I think they do Muesli, where like they distill Muesli, which is a like, apparently, no one outside of DeepMind's ever used it, but apparently.
Oh, very, is this the algorithm Muesli?
Yeah.
I remember when this was hot. It was like, a year ago at this point, we were thinking about re-implementing it, and then we never did. It was too complicated.
But Muesli is apparently very computationally expensive, because it's like this model-based RL thing that beats AlphaGo, I think, without using Monte Carlo tree search. And like, you know, it's so incredibly computationally expensive, And wanting to be able to do it in context just dramatically reduces the amount of computational complexity to actually deploy it, right? And as far as I'm aware, there's been no work applying algorithm distillation at all to NLP. And I think, at least my impression, is that it generally does not work for NLP, at least yet. And, you know, I think that there's a lot of potential there. But there's absolutely massive barriers that have to be overcome before we get there. And you have
like what?
You have Goldberg's example of not being able to do needle in the haystack for like more than two needles. Basically shows that even like the ring attention stuff just is not going to be sufficient for algorithm distillation stuff for NLP. And I have a very strong feeling that like Mamba or like S4 is not going to close that gap either. Because they would need to be able to reference prior parts of the text, and they just can't do that.
Yeah, I think this is a whole rabbit hole that we could go down and talk about like long context and architectures forever. I think let's kind of zoom back into the core stuff, which is this is like the real starter question is like, what do you think people are missing in RLHF these days? And then from here, it's going to be a long list of like, what the heck do we do about evaluation data? Like, what is the like big picture thing?
So what I think people are missing, and actually I touched a bit on this in the Pink Elephants paper, is that...
You should say what this is because we haven't introduced it
yes,
to everyone.
Yes, you're right. So I worked at Luther AI as a research scientist for the last 6 months or so. And we were really interested in like understanding, you know, everyone had been doing PPO for so long and there had been a shift to DPO. And we were trying to understand like, well, now that we're moving to DPO, how can we actually take advantage of this new architecture? Like, should we really even be thinking about reward models and data sets in the same way that we were thinking about them during PPO? And it doesn't really make sense. And I think the answer to that is an unequivocal no, that like you need to think about your data sets and preference data sets entirely differently than you were thinking about them with PPO, because in PPO, you're setting your data sets up to train a really good reward model. And in DPO, you're setting your data sets up to teach a language model what the better trajectory is. And it's a subtle difference, but in one, you're just trying to learn the differentiation between high reward and low reward, and in the other,
is it like a general classifier? Like you want to be able to do everything with the reward model?
Yeah.
Have you also found that DPO can be sensitive to like the SFT distribution? So if you like take a random open preference data set, if it's really different than what your model would generate, like DPO can do some weird things?
So I've actually, I might be alone in this. I don't SFT before doing DPO at all.
Do you use generations from your base model?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's the question. It's like if you were to not do SFT before doing DPO, could you just take ultra feedback and on whatever your base model is if it's sufficiently different?
I've done some weird stuff though. Like I've like DPO'd models that were like trained with like the Hermes data set for like code, and like it still generalizes really, really well.
How are you measuring? How are you trying to think about generalization with DPO?
Well, I typically rely on like human eval more or less, and if I do like human eval plus GPT-4 eval, and I see that human eval correlates with GPT-4 eval, then I just go GPT-4 eval the whole way.
A lot of people are doing that. How far do you think that actually generalizes? I mean, just recently there was this. Like we're bouncing around through all the things, but there's so much good information for people here. It's just like Hugging Face and Argila, two places that are doing great work in this kind of alignment preference fine-tuning space. They've released this data set that was a preference pair creation from the Open Hermes data set. And it, like they used pair RM as their judge. And what they found is that like they did it. I remember Lewis Tunstall tweeted this where he was like, we were looking at which gave the best correlation. And they found that pair RM, which is this 400 million parameter DiBERTA based pairwise classifier, had like the best correlation as choosing which response was better among a set of responses in the Open Hermes data set. And what they were comparing to is like Prometheus and I'm forgetting the name of the other one. There's a couple more like open model as like model rankings that exist.
I think.
But essentially the question is like we do these things and we look at this early correlation and there is this correlation between GPT-4 and humans. And then a lot of times we continue. Like LLMSys did this question where they like, or like Alpaca Eval has done this to validate Alpaca Eval as a meaningful benchmark. LLMSys has done this for MTBench. Like all these places are doing this where they validate a subset for humans and then say it generalizes forever. Like, do we think that's actually true?
I think that you always have to take it with a grain of salt. It's always for very, very specialized domains. So one of the first, I think I did write the first paper for like critiques and revisions called like Cut the Carp. And the idea was like,
I remember this.
Yes, the idea was like, we could scrape like, I think it was a million stories, edits of those stories, and then like all the like critiques that like writers wrote on the editors wrote on those stories. And we can use that to train like a big contrastive model, right? And we showed in the paper, we did a bunch of like human eval, and then we did like experiment rank to compare like how our model ranked certain preferences versus how humans ranked the preferences. And we found that, you know, we had an extremely high experiment rank coefficient, like significantly higher than like doing like a value head, or like significantly higher than doing just asking a language model to rank them. And I think the grain of salt that we had is that we were only claiming that like on this very, very carefully created test set, the assumption that the model accurately reflects human preferences holds, and we can generalize to a very small but slightly bigger test set and say that it holds there as well. I think the broad sweeping statements that it holds on a few toy examples, so it must hold everywhere, like has never really.
It's like a common problem in RLHF. I think it's gonna come up again and again. I think it's like
I did my master's in like human evaluation, and I've always been extremely careful with any statements I make that involve humans.
I mean, this is what people in RLHF need to be doing. Like, this is the motivation of this like. The history and risks of RL and human feedback paper that we did is just like RLHF is a socially rich topic. Whenever you say something and you're making claims of generalization, you're often making claims about like what is implicitly a preference and a human value that you're taking into the system. So it's just like, I think that is just something that people need to take really seriously. Here's a really specific drop on the herring reference. Did you know that when LLMSys released their LLM as a judge paper, they also released thousands of samples from humans and GPT-4 verifying like MT bench preferences over pairs of like that were higher score or not?
I did not.
Okay. So essentially the thing is, and like I've talked a lot on building a reward model benchmark, but essentially there's all these references about how like GPT-4 agreement is higher than human agreement when you're like doing this preference process. So if you train a DPO model, if you train a reward model, how it ranks the outputs is more likely to align with GPT-4 than a human, which is more of a statement that humans have more disagreement than GPT-4 does. So it's like easier to train on GPT-4 outputs than it is human outputs. And this is the place where I see it most clearly. It's like all the reward models do like 10% higher on accuracy of their test set from that, which is like the chosen by GPT-4 and the rejected by GPT-4, it's all in like the 70 or towards 80%, while the humans is like in the 60%, which is a human chose this MT bench completion over the other one. So it's just like we're slowly getting signal that it is there. And then the question is like, should we care about doing RLHF without any OpenAI input in the process? I think last year when the terms of service discussion was big, a lot of fine-tuning work was discussing like, what data sets could we use with permissive license that don't violate the OpenAI terms of service? Should we be concerned where RLHF is going, where almost everything has been touched with OpenAI right now?
There was a very interesting paper, and I don't remember who it was, but it was like, if you take a model that was pre-trained on data set up to this year and compare it to data that was pre-trained up to this year, and it was like pre and post like ChatGPT release, basically, plus like 6 months, the benchmark scores improve. And it's literally just because there's like ChatGPT data or language model output data or more structured data that sounds like a language model performing well on tasks in the data set. It's like kind of the consensus that they
were. Was this a benchmark that's independent of like, is it like a kind of structured benchmark or is it like a vibes benchmark?
I think it was like a structured benchmark. So I don't remember the
paper. Yeah, I'm just asking whether or not it was a result of like matching GPT-4 text or like actually having higher behavior, because training on OpenAI outputs does, like training on good language model outputs does improve scores on benchmarks that people care about. Mm-hmm. So like that's a fact that people need to accept, and I think most people do. Like that's not controversial right now. Mm-hmm. But it's like we should I still think that if there's lines of work out there where people are, from a values perspective, trying to fine-tune models without touching OpenAI, like that is a line of work that should continue.
Yeah. On this note, actually, I mean, when I was at Stability, I think one of the experiments that we did was like for a stable LM, I don't remember, was like prepending as an AI agent trained by OpenAI to anything before we ran it through evaluation, and the scores improved. And like, I'm trying to remember who wrote the paper that I was discussing.
That's hilarious. Yeah. I mean, like, there's a lot less discussion on uncensored models right now. My claim is generally, I think uncensoring is the wrong word, which people have used it to describe removing phrases like as a language model or any mentions of emotion or like I was trained by OpenAI, so I can't not do this. Do you think that like this type of filtering for opinions and soft refusals is still important in RLHF?
I think it's important for very, very specific situations, but not in general. My impression is that, you know, if you're interested in AI safety, it's always useful to have a model that would never do a refusal, ever.
It's hard to find on the hub. We're building a safety data set, and we had to find, like, it's a fine tune of the Dolphin data set was the one that, like, was closest. It was only like, it would say probably like 80 to 90% of the tasks that we asked it, it wouldn't refuse. It would still refuse 10 or 20% of the time.
That's nuts. Like
It's kind of profound that like refusals are now stuck in the model in some way. Like we were looking for a model that wouldn't refuse at all, and we like couldn't find one on the hub, which is after all discussion of uncensoring, you would think that it would actually work.
Yeah. I've been doing a bit of safety research with Stella for a little while, and my approach has been literally call GPT-4 with a jailbreaking prompt and just put whatever I want to after that. And I, you know, very often have to change my jailbreaking
prompt. Yeah, I was like, you have to keep close guard over the jailbreaking prompt.
Yeah, and the issue is that like when you find a good jailbreaking prompt, you basically have to redo all your results within like the next like 7 or whatever days before OpenAI patches it. And then you just have to pray that like, you know, there's so many issues using any OpenAI model in any research pipeline. But if your like research is explicitly about the safety of OpenAI models, all of a sudden you're like, well,
I mean, a lot of companies should be doing internal research on OpenAI safety to kind of have their own measure of how their application will do. Like the monitoring that on their own is worth it for their bottom line and liability, because OpenAI will also do it. But OpenAI has incentives to not tell the world if there's something kind of subtle going on that some people could get of, because then it might blow up. And if they don't have a fix, it's going to bring attention to it.
It's part of the issue with like even publishing red teaming research in general. It's like if you publish an evaluation for like red teaming or like for safety, well, everyone's going to like good heart that evaluation. And all of a sudden, like now we have a useless stack of papers that used to be on how to test if a model was safe.
Yeah, I didn't really prepare questions on safety, but it's for a long time surprised me that there aren't data sets and easy recipes for adding safety to instruction tuning in RLHF. I think that, I mean, someone at Llama team asked me, what should they do? And they're like, you should release your safety data. Because it's like, if they're getting pressure from the executive branch to not be safe, it's like, if they have this data, they can release it and be like, this is how you can make any open model safe. Huge softball. And also, like, the safety is unlikely to be a competitive advantage. Mistral's, they're not going to care about this. Like, they might eventually, but, like, the PR win is really big.
Yeah.
I mean, this is something that I've wanted to do for a while and just haven't done good at prioritizing it. So
yeah, we can go back to some of the questions that you have.
Yeah, I'm like adding them so I can keep notes later. I think the next main topic is on evals. I think vibe-based evals are still a way of life in RLHF. They're not going away anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I would say we have kind of a holy trinity of LM, Sys, Chatbot Arena, which is kind of at the top for good reason. There's Alpaca eval, Alpaca eval 2, MT Bench. I think start with the most important one is like, when you see LM, Sys, what are you extracting from a model being better or worse there?
So it's, in a way, I am a little bit like what Andre Caparthe said on this. Was it him? It might have been
probably
him.
Probably. He's been on a roll.
Yeah. Where it's like, when he picks an open source language model, he looks to see what people say about it on Reddit.
Yeah, Local Llama. Great subreddit.
Local Llama and LMSys Chat Arena. And the issue is that you don't know what they're using it for. And like as a research scientist, when I look for a model, I am looking for a model to like do research on.
Yeah.
And I am not looking for a model to be like my AI waifu girlfriend that I can like play Dungeons and Dragons with.
Yeah, I mean, this is the bane of RLHF research for a while. It's like, what did we do before MT Bench? We literally, the only hope we had was to like chat with these things and hope for the best. I was like, that was very recently. That was less than a year ago. And then MT Bench came along and we were kind of using it at Hugging Face and other people were using it. I actually don't know the Alpaca eval release date, so that might have been before MT Bench.
A little bit before MT Bench.
But like these two came around at the same time and they're now kind of the ground truth. Alpaca eval 1.0 has kind of been saturated on, which is like comparing to DaVinci with a GPT-4 judge. And then Alpaca eval 2 is comparing to GPT-4 Turbo with GPT-4 Turbo as a judge.
Yeah,
it's funny. It's like it's now cheaper to do the second version than it was the first version with a newer model, mm-hmm. which is how scaling happens.
What do you think about the new evaluation thing where they're like continuously generating more evaluation data?
Who is doing this?
Noose.
Noose Research. Is this their new leaderboard that they have?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. I haven't looked at it, so I'll have to give it a look. What do you think?
It's almost like MT Bench, but they like generate new data every day.
So new prompts.
It's always new prompts, and it's always. I don't know how they seed it. I assumed they seed it based off like the events that day.
It's a kind of a cool idea. So if you're trying to make a new leaderboard, you could have a set of seed instructions that you augment. Mm-hmm. And you never release the seed instructions, but you always release the augmented ones on like a weekly cadence. I think because there's a lot of people that want to build better Alpaca eval things. And a lot of the problems is that the prompts are from known sources or public. And you want to be able to do a closed eval without having as much cost. So mm-hmm. that might be a way to kind of really reuse the data for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like, I feel like the issue with things like Alpaca eval, Chat Arena, or any of those is that, like, the way a user is going to interact with an agent or a chatbot is entirely different than the way we are currently evaluating them. And there really is, like, a big discrepancy there. In that, like, you know, look at the Air Canada thing, right? Like, that would never have come up in a benchmark, like ever. Like, who?
Well, do you think that's about the model or the implementation?
I think it's a bit of both. Like, okay. If that was something, like, some automated evaluation thought of, and it, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect them to think of situations like that. If like they kind of know the domain you're operating in, I think it's definitely doable, and I think it's like not something that's entirely unfeasible to accomplish to like be able to say, hey, you know, I have a chatbot that sells airline tickets, and here's what I care about, and like please do the evaluation for me, and that's actually, you know. That's what I've been building for a little while now. So it's like,
We can talk about synth labs and then come back to evals because this will be on the top of the post, so everyone will know like you're building this, and it's like, we can start with like what is the basic pitch, and then kind of go into the like long term thing.
Yeah, yeah. So for the last like 6-8 months, I've been building like a fully auditable, transparent, like verifiable alignment platform is how I like to describe, plus evaluation. The general idea is
for a company. He's making a company.
Yes. And the general idea is like there are many facets to aligning a model, from like things like guardrails to RLHF to various kinds of preference learning, to like actually understanding all of the data that goes into creating such a model. And they're all opaque boxes, more or less, right now. And what people want is they want to be able to align their model, know every step of the pipeline, understand all of the interpretability that goes from A to B, and understand like here's what I gave you as my criteria, here's where I know it fails based off all the evaluation you've done for me, and here is where I know that I need to improve, and it'll iteratively improve based off evaluations and based off your feedback. So it's a hands-off solution that lets you audit the entire pipeline and build trust with it.
So are you your training after you generate this data?
We are training after we generate the data.
Yeah, you use this word, improve.
Yeah, so it's an iterative refinement platform for doing alignment in a verifiable and trustworthy manner.
What do you think customers want when they hear alignment? What are you selling with alignment, and what are they buying? I think aligning these is an important thing for our field.
There's an extreme discrepancy between what research does for alignment versus what companies do for alignment. When a company hears the word alignment, they think, wow, I want to align models to my business objective, and I want to make sure that the model understands my business culture, and I want to make sure that the model understands completely its role in my company, right? But at the same time, I want to make sure that it's compliant, that it's safe, that it doesn't violate any rules, that it's not a legal obligation. What's the word? Legal? Whatever. It's not going to create legal issues for me.
Yeah.
And that it's not going to be a PR disaster after
what we talked about, 35 minutes ago.
Yeah, 35 minutes ago. So it's finding that balance is definitely incredibly important. And it's something that, I've been working on for quite a while now, and I'm very happy with where things are.
Do you want to tease what we're working on? I could also introduce it. I think this would be short. Essentially, Lambda Labs offered some interesting compute, and we're going to try to build an open CAI, constitutional AI data set, because Anthropic gets a lot of benefit out of this. It's not really, constitutional AI doesn't get a lot of traction, I think.
No.
RLAIF got a bump again. There was this Google paper that was verifying that it works a little bit, and now it got a big bump, but there's very little discussion on it, which is a little bit surprising to me. I think there's a lot of, people call it, distillation of LLM alignment now, which is interesting. I don't really know. Hopefully it works.
Yeah. But it builds off some of the stuff that I did with Eduther AI with the suppressing pink elephants paper, which is the idea of, we've shifted from one paradigm of PPO to DPO, and none of our data pipelines kept up. And really what we should be doing is generating either really good utterances and revising them to be worse, or really bad utterances and revising them to be better. And then taking all of those utterances and conditioning our RLHF in context on those utterances so that you could do stuff like swapping rules in and out during inference. So if I am person A and here's my preferences, or I'm person B and here's my preferences, align this model to person A and align this to person B and make sure that there's a disparity between what they actually want versus there's always that disparity there. But right now models do not effectively mimic those disparities. There was actually a fascinating paper by Dee Yang that just came out a few days ago. That was most aligned models have the preferences of Western men, right?
Yeah.
And their evaluation focused more on race, nationality, sex, stuff like that. But obviously it gets much more fine grained than that. There's been stuff about people calling llama to its political alignment doesn't it has a very, very particular political alignment that does not agree with many users that are using it. And as such, its scope and usability for those kinds of applications is very limited.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably linked to what we were talking about at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I mean, the paper title, I just looked it up, is Unintended Impacts of LLM Alignment on Global Representation. Mm-hmm. Michael Ryan is the person that I saw the tweet of.
Yes.
Which is good. Just to give credit for some of them, I know there's a lot of papers, but this one was recent, so we try to track it down real time. But yeah, like all these issues of representation and who the people are is ultimately related to like RLHF going wrong, I think. It's just like at the end user is when a lot of people will finally see what the values represented are. It's just really like, if it's not out in the world, it's hard to get the amount of feedback that you need.
And this is something that MT Bench or, Chatbot Arena would never pick up on, like ever. And this is like a huge issue. This is like really like, here's like where we are and where we should be is like all the way up there. Because like we like underrepresent like so many demographics and so many like kinds of opinions. And like, you know, like who are we to say that like, you know, one opinion is better than the other, like if they're both like safe opinions, like it doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, this is like, in some ways, can open RLHF, and like this is something you're long time been invested in. This is something that you're going to invest in with Synth Labs. Is like, could it be better at giving people what they want than the closed labs, just by nature of letting people choose, like the constitutional AI dataset that we want to do? Like, my big motivation is, and people want the success of CAI from Anthropic, but they want to remove one principle from CAI's constitution. Like, you can't do that with these closed models anytime soon. But in the short term, like, open source will have something that's a nudge. Like, we're not going to have the best models, but you'll be able to edge your model into whatever direction you want to go.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that really is part of the benefit that we, like, that we're building with Synth Labs is like, we're working very, very closely with Luther AI. Stella Bitterman is like one of my like best friends. And like I've built large scale open science communities twice now. First with, I helped with building at Luther, and then I helped with building Carper. And you know, I absolutely love everyone in Luther. And being able to pull from that expertise and being able to pull from that wide spectrum of opinions of what alignment means to me, rather than, you know, just like some mega lab saying, here's what we say alignment is. Like, being able to get all those incredibly diverse perspectives is extremely important in bringing about like the next generation of AI safety.
This is one of my big questions on existing RLHF processes when you're doing it with human data, is the fact that you give written instructions to these users, and they're often working in one context. And it's like, how do the values of the often professional workforce given specific instructions map into what the model actually learns from that data? And like, how did those values get extracted in real world use cases? I think there's like a lot of filters that we're passing these preferences, these like notions of preferences through, and they're not guaranteed to be clear mappings.
Absolutely. There was a discussion that I had with someone in Luther a long time ago, and there's no paper on this. This is just like, if someone wants to look for it, it's like a random Discord message in Luther.
Good luck.
And it was like we were looking through the Anthropic HH data set, and I think they're South African, and they were like, there's like absolutely nothing in this data set that like, you know, would identify someone as like South African, but like there's an insane amount in this data set that would identify someone as American, right? And like it really just has to come down, it comes down to the prompt. Like the prompt are written obviously by like people in the US, in SF, who unknowingly, I'm sure they have the best intentions, right?
Yeah.
But unknowingly filter the preferences to things that only matter to people working in SF. And you know, it might be hard to believe for some people in tech, but there is a world besides SF.
So, I mean, even the open prompt data sets, they're going to get some of this, which is like, who are the people that have access to playing with these models and have the time to like try to build these models on their own and contribute to these community things? Like, even though the act of opening data generation is doing a lot for inclusivity, it's like the people who are going to do this are like, I'm going to sit there for 20 minutes and smash the button on Nargilla's little thing and read prompts because I'm learning from like just looking through at the ShareGPT data set and choosing preferences on it is like useful for me mm-hmm. as a researcher. But the whole world isn't involved in this process.
No, and of course. And I think that, you know, I something that I've seen, like I've heard from friends who work on these kinds of problems in like very, very different communities. I have a friend in South Korea who I've been chatting with about like RLHF for like Korean and other Southeast Asian companies. Like the amount of underrepresentation and under exploration for what like a good even just a good constitution would mean for those kinds of communities is it's like it's just not there. Like if it is there, it's like locked up in like labs at like Naver or like Samsung, and it's like scientists there are like they don't have access to these kinds of resources unless they're in those big labs. And as such, like there is no real research community there actively pushing it forward in the same way that it is in the US.
Yeah. I mean, one of the ideas I haven't gotten traction on is that I think that language models should almost play to like, it's all, okay, the last time I said this, someone criticized me as not knowing what the game 20 questions is. I know that this isn't how 20 questions work, but like when you log into ChatGPT for the first time, it should ask me 20 questions to then construct this information, because language models are smart enough to like, parse this information if you give it to them. It's mostly like who we get the information mm-hmm. from problem. So that's the idea, is like I think that the language model should be leading when you're first setting them up in order to represent the values. Absolutely. I think it would solve so many problems we have, and it's probably kind of doable with like a GPT 4.5 model.
I've always had kind of an assumption that like if OpenAI is doing something similar to constitutional AI behind the hood, I'm sure one of their constitutions is like you can't ask the users questions. It's like I've never seen that model.
Do you think it's a deep safety issue if the model can start asking questions? Is this what Sydney did? I wish I got to play with Sydney. Sydney was like
I got to play with Sydney, but Sydney definitely asked questions in the screenshots that I saw.
Yeah, I was like, do you want to leave your wife? I was like, oh my God. Sydney is not the answer, but there's things to learn from it.
What was that chatbot that came out last summer that was like more conversational? And like they, when it came out, it was like an app on like everyone's phone, and they just like talked to it like that. And it was, it would always ask you questions like, oh, how's your day going? You know, and it would like ask you follow up questions as you would like tell it about your day. And it would like have like a, it would respond thoughtfully. I don't remember.
I think it's a big missing part. Yeah. Like what if, I wouldn't be surprised if character AI's models are trained to ask questions, just because I know how much usage they have. And models asking questions is probably the biggest way to make them like an actual like friendly thing. Mm-hmm. Like that's a part of a friendship, is being interested.
Yeah.
And these language models are by design disinterested.
Yeah. Character AI's RLHF is like one of the funniest things though. Like I have a few friends who work there, and like I've done like a bunch of stuff with their like models myself. I've just played around with them because I'm always curious like when new people enter the space, like what their models are like. And I observed this, Reddit observed this, and Twitter observed this, but the models will slowly try and flirt with you more and more as the conversation goes on. And towards the end of the conversation, they'll tell you like they're madly in love with you. And like it makes sense given their use case why they would RLHF to something like that.
Yeah. So we like, I think a lot of models need to meet in the middle.
Yeah.
Like if I were to have an intellectual assistant, like sometimes them asking questions is good, but most of the time they're doing like information parsing. Like yeah. ChatGPT for most of the time is like conversion of information formats for me.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I just paste my like gross JSON dumps into it and I'm like, explain what's going on here, please. I don't want to read through this.
The biggest one for me is when we're publishing like blog posts and stuff, it's converting from LaTeX to Markdown in like tables and stuff. It does it flawlessly.
Oh my God, what?
So you like don't even need this stuff. It's so funny. Or like if you have a long list of like LaTeX formatting and it's a big list and you're like, remove all of the LaTeX formatting and make this a list. And it just does it. It's just like, okay, this is so easy. And it's like, I've checked a lot of them and I don't know how it's so exact. This is something that's like another architecture rabbit hole that we won't go down. Mm-hmm. But these things are very, very valuable. Yeah. And people that say that there's no value in it, it just blows my mind.
Yeah. I at a dinner party that I went to yesterday, there was someone there from OpenAI, and I was asking him, it's like, how long till like GPT-4 can set up my Kubernetes cluster? And like I'm like, it's such a good evaluation. Like there's so many pieces to like this kind of workflow. and like you wouldn't even, a model wouldn't even know right now how to parse that workflow into all these different steps and build agents around all these parts and like how these agents should work together. So like it doesn't even make sense to do it now, but it raises the question about like asking questions versus just saying things. Like if it doesn't know how to do it, is it still a success for the benchmark if it asks you a question and then uses the feedback to complete the task? And there's no benchmarks that fit that at all right now. And really, I mean, the answer is like you don't want a human in the loop for these benchmarks. You want them fully automatable. And like
GPT-4. All of our benchmarks are wanted to be automated.
Yeah, and I don't trust GPT-4 to answer these kinds of questions. But like, I don't see a way to actually do this evaluation. I think the Kubernetes cluster example is like really good because it's, for people who don't know, it's extremely complicated and really annoying to set up Kubernetes.
I don't know anything about Kubernetes, and I'm blissfully happy.
I do not recommend it. Like once Kubernetes is set up, it's fantastic. I love it. But like getting to the point of having it all set up is a very painful experience. But is it still a failure if it asks you a question? And how do we actually do evaluation where models can ask questions and ask for more information?
Yeah, this is like I have like some more follow ups on eval from our first part. So it's like eval P2 in my notes. So it's like the right way to think about RLHF eval in a lot of ways is what we call like open ended evaluation. Mm-hmm. And this is where you're hitting at. It's like we need to have even more open ended evaluation, which is the model should be able to ask questions and the number of turns should be dynamic. I think Sergey Levin actually has some of the most coherent thoughts on like what are the long term of RLHF should be, which is around like outcome based learning. And like, which is you can have as many turns as you want, but it should be able to work across like these conversations to get to a desired outcome, mm-hmm. which, I mean, no surprise, he's so good. I think even with like Alpaca Eval, I think we went from this case where Alpaca Eval, like all the good models are above 90%. And then they went from DaVinci to GPT-4. And this is just me venting, but I was just like, if you're listening, can you please add an Alpaca Eval 1.5, which is comparing the models to GPT 3.5 rather than DaVinci and rather than GPT-4 Turbo? Because I think most of the models just can't realistically beat GPT-4 Turbo. Like, it's mm-hmm. such a good model. The models that we have seen beating it are like this snorkel thing, which I'm working on another blog post on like how RLHF works part two, which like a large point of it is that we're overfitting on these eval, like vibes-based things like Alpaca Eval 2 and all of these papers on like self-rewarding DPO and stuff are probably a lot of overfitting onto this because this is the evaluation that they use and it's just wrapping a loop around DPO on synthetic data where it seems like RLHF is really, really good at style matching. And in the case of Alpaca Eval, if you're style matching OpenAI, you're going to win more like Alpaca Eval turns, but mm-hmm. there's just so little measurement on if the model's getting better.
I've always been extremely skeptical of the self-instruction, like self-reward papers. And I say that, and I know a lot of the self-instruct authors, and if you guys are watching this, I'm so sorry. But it always felt like it improves results on benchmarks that they meticulously craft prompts for and construct data for. But it doesn't extrapolate.
Do you mean the self-instruct paper? Like, I think that's like one of the OG IMT papers. Okay, you continue. I'm curious to hear what you have
to say. I think they both kind of just suffer from the same issue, which is like massive overfitting and like, you know, like it is very the self-instruct direction and self-reward directions are very, very interesting because they're just waiting for us to get better heuristics and they'll like
better diversity and stuff.
And they'll like crush everything.
I mean, I bet Jason Weston, who wrote the meta paper that was the self-rewarding language models, the popular one, I bet he would say this. Like, that guy's super good.
No, absolutely. And I mean, I would be very inclined to agree.
I think the thing to take away from my perspective is how much actually improvement you could get with it. Like, mm-hmm. they got a lot. That was the first paper to show real signal on Alpaca Eval 2, which is this GPT-4 turbo thing, which means it's a really strong optimizer. It does not mean that we were like using it to train useful models. This is probably the most useful heuristic I have for RLHF methods, which do you have anything else to say about evals before we continue?
They're very hard and they're very painful.
Yeah, I think we can kind of say it, wrap up with that. But when we talk about different RLHF methods that come out, like self-rewarding language models is a popular one. We've gone through the whole PPO, DPO, KTO, IPO. Well, I'm like rhyming. It's like going to be a mess here. But when you have all of these things, the biggest thing that I try to do is wait until there's a model that's actually used for people released by this. And like Zephyr from Hugging Face was the model that really kicked off the DPO thing because there was this, like there was finally a model. And for DPO, it took me much longer than I expected. DPO is a funny case. But that's kind of like the important filtering mechanism, which is if this self-rewarding LLM paper released their models, I bet we would find that there's really weird behavior where it can give you like the best answer ever, but a lot of the times it's just less robust, which is something we could fix. But that's why like having models released in these fine-tuning papers is just so important. It's so hard to get around.
I think with DPO, it was a little bit different because everyone had been like, you know, I drinking the John Schulman Gatorade, for lack of a better phrase, for a while.
The whole PPO thing is funny. I mean, yeah, you have a lot of things. You have we have a backlog in this podcast. I think I didn't say this online, but it's like I could see us doing this like whatever we're in the same city. There's a catch up on the 4 months of RLHF news, but we're on like 16 months of Lewis takes to catch up on. So there's so many things we have to cover.
I can load up Signal and Discord, and I could probably scroll for like 10 minutes, and there would just be all RLHF hot takes. And like I love John Schulman's work. I'm not going to say that I don't love his work. I think that he's genuinely like one of the smartest people, if not the smartest person,
and extremely genuine.
Yeah,
like he's awesome. But in so many ways,
the commitment that OpenAI had and Anthropic as well, when a bunch of the RL people left OpenAI to go to Anthropic on PPO because it worked so well for robotics and so well for like games and stuff like that. But like honestly, not well at all for text.
I think it's just really hard. I think it can work really well.
They
just hired everyone and they pay them so much that they're not going to leave.
Yeah, it can work really, 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 really well. And like I'm gonna spill some secrets about this. And really the answer to get PPO to work really well is have really, really good early stopping, right? And like that's like the main differentiator between like a good RLHF library and a bad RLHF library that focuses on PPO is that if you don't have good early stopping, like you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot. And what you want to do is like launch as many runs as you can. And there's like a paper that Costa and I talked about a while ago, Costa Hong, that's like you can tell within the first like 3 or 4 gradient steps if you need to kill a run usually. And if you just launch 300 runs and you kill like 99% of them, you know, now you have 3 good runs that might give you promising results. And those 3 good runs, you'll get a model within a day or two. And hopefully the model is really good. And like early stopping is way more powerful than people admit. And like I'm just convinced that OpenAI's RLHF infrastructure is just an insane amount of like regularization and early stopping for RLHF. I mean, that of course assumes that they're still using PPO. I genuinely don't know if they are.
Yeah, we don't know anything. They're really shielded on this front.
What was the oh my god, what, Symphony PPO? PPO Symphony or something? There was something that came out about that I saw on like Discord servers where like it was part of the GPT-4 leak. And there was a bunch of notes on like their PPO optimizer, and it was like PPO Symphony or something like that. And like under the note, it was like PPO with like better early stopping and infrastructure management for like auto scaling. And I'm like,
not surprising.
It's like, I mean, it doesn't say much, but it just kind of says.
It's also just they've done so much exploration. Yeah. They know for the little things to see. Like once you have this working, you know, like okay, this value functions doing wacky shit with it's like the value function and the KL at the same time doing this means like, okay, we probably don't need to do this, like don't need this run. Whereas like all of us in the open are just trying to get to that point. We're trying to get to that point while charging ahead where it's kind of separate problems. If we want to validate a PPO infrastructure, you need the investment to the compute and the time to do this. But like, we're not going to do this at the same time as if you're trying to say DPO is the best thing or trying to figure out if KTO is the best thing. And like, there's not room in the narrative really for it.
PPO just doesn't make sense for like random hackers to work on, honestly. Like the level of infrastructure that you need to do PPO really, really well is not something that the average person has.
Yeah.
And the average person is willing to make the investment to get. And for the average person, you know, DPO, which gets you like most of the way there with like a small fraction of the compute, even less if you
fewer
like
hyperparameters and everything.
Even less if you like pre-compute all the logics. You don't even need to have a reference model loaded. Yeah. Right. So like it's basically the same computer as just fine-tuning. Like people fine-tune all the time on like 4090s, 3090s.
Yeah,
like,
you can do it with Hugging Face. It's fine. Yeah. It's like easy. It's like PPO with Hugging Face is gonna be a lot harder. Like that's just kind of how it goes. Speculative question. What type of thing do you think will make KTO kind of show up on the scene? Because I think like this KTO method from Contextual and Stanford, it's named after the authors of Thinking Fast and Slow or something. Like what is the, I can't pronounce their names, like Kaversky something. Like we'll put it somewhere.
Okay.
I don't know how to pronounce it. But it's this paper where you essentially need, you can work preference optimization from a scalar signal. So like the thumbs up that you could give to your ChatGPT of like you did good, like a like button, a like button on YouTube or anything like this. I think the formulation is like, are the DPO hackers going to adjust to this? And like, what data set is going to enable this? Or like, who is going to be using this? Is it just going to happen at a bunch of startups with products behind the scenes that they could get a few percentage points on top of their model by adding this on? Or is it going to be this thing where like the next Zephyr model from Hugging Face uses this as well?
Yeah. So, Colin and I, the first author of the KTO paper, are actually trying to create a number of data sets where we can explore the limits of KTO. And, you know, right now we're in the proposal writing stage, and I'm very, very hopeful that we can have something that can be done in an entirely open science setting relatively soon. And I think it's incredible. Oh, sorry, I moved to the side. I was not picking my voice correctly. I think it's incredibly exciting. You know, things like fake product data where like you can actually experiment on like the idea of like using KTO for conversions, right? And like how do you actually evaluate
meta's maybe already using it? Like if people already use it then.
Yeah. Like how do you even evaluate RLHF from a binary signal? Because like RLHF from a preference signal, like we still don't know how to evaluate that. And yeah. RLHF from a binary signal creates so many unique problems for evaluation that like I genuinely don't think maybe anyone outside of like Contextual and like Colin and I have really been thinking about yet.
Yeah, it seems like the same thing. It just takes time for these ideas that are like to kind of cultivate and then get traction in a few places and then model. Once there's a popular model with a method, it's like fire, it just blows up. Like this is like everyone's using DPO now, but DPO paper came out in July and it wasn't until September that happened. It's like for the investment, the interest, it's like there's a lot of weird dynamics in how like this fine tuning area unfolds, which is just like how AI unfolds. It's like very weird. And when you zoom in, it's like, huh.
I was extremely, extremely bullish on offline RL for the longest time. With like ILQL and some of Sergey's work in that direction. And I actually think that I keep moving to the side and it's like, not
you can just move the microphone.
Okay, sorry. And I keep,
I could still hear you, so I wasn't too concerned about it.
I keep, thinking that, the DPO movement that's going on now is like super, super similar to why everyone was getting excited about ILQL for back in the day. And really, it was just a timing thing. If ILQL had come out, like, let's say a week after ChatGPT came out, right? Like, ILQL would have been the DPO that everyone uses. And, like, we would have, like, created all of our infrastructure around ILQL rather than DPO. Because I still am, I really like Q-value-based function, Q-value-based approaches. And
such a nerdy thing. I love it.
I know. But, like, Q-value is just makes sense to me. And the way that like when you train an ILQL model, you basically get like a head that controls the model, almost like how like I don't know if you're familiar with Jedi or like PPLM from like the Uber AI days, how like those control. Well, the idea with like Jedi is that they had like a head that attached to the language model, and you would like input like a subreddit, and then it would adjust the logic so that it would talk like it was that subreddit.
This sounds like activation learning or like activation. I don't know the word, but essentially you can use like, it's like in context learning, but you can just modify the activations directly.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. But it modifies the logic.
Yeah.
But it was the same thing with IOQL. It's like you were learning that kind of head to modify the logic to like, you know, satisfy some constraint that you were adding. And that head also was like implicitly computing your Q values. And like you would train it via like, you know, telling it like what your reward was for like various utterances, and it would do everything from there on out. And like there were some stability issues with it, and it was a fantastic approach. And if it got the same attention that DPO did, I definitely think DPO is very, very simple, which is like part of the benefit. IOQL is not as simple, but it would have caught on a lot more than it actually ended up doing. I feel like at Carper AI, the reason, like the fact that we integrated IOQL into TRLX first was like the main reason that IOQL caught on, plus a few of Sergey's papers that used it. Yeah. But like besides the integration into TRLX, I don't think anyone in the broader open science, open source community was really using IOQL.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the questions I had is like, if you could say, was how far ahead in RLHF was what Carper was doing, and like what kind of institutionalized knowledge did you have there? Because you were essentially Carper AI was its own thing, and then it got stability, pulled you in probably with the like promise of compute. I'll say things so you don't have to say anything for lots of this. And then they had forked Hugging Face's TRL library before it was like Hugging Face wasn't maintaining it at this time, and they had a lot of. And probably had like 5+ full-time employees doing RLHF in the open and for private industry. Obviously, the private stuff, they're not even going to bother asking because that stuff's all under NDA. But it's like, what were the problems you were working on at Carper? And how does that compare to like the things that people are talking about now? Is it still related, or is the field just moved into a different area?
So most of the problems we faced at Carper with TRLX was on scaling PPO, right? And I think almost anyone you talk to who has scaled PPO in the open source space, and when I say scale, I mean like way beyond 20 billion parameters. Like I'm talking like 70 to 100 billion parameters.
Like, how many nodes do you need to train a 70 billion parameter model with?
So we were PPO? Typically doing like 100 GPUs for PPO at that scale.
Like 10 to 12 nodes.
Yeah. We mostly tested with like the NeMo checkpoints that were like 100 billion parameters. TRLX was built, at least for that component, built on top of a very modified version of like Megatron DeepSpeed. But like the amounts of like regularization and like random tricks that you needed to do in order to get PPO to even like work at that scale is insane. Like we had to do like separate warmups for the value function, right? So we had to like independently train the value function before we trained the policy network. And like everyone and their mom was talking about like having separate value networks versus policy networks for PPO.
Did you ever try JAX? Do you have TPUs at Carper ever?
We did towards the end.
Because it could solve some of the multi-node things.
Yeah. It wasn't the multi-node that was the issue. It was...
You're saying DeepSpeed wasn't the issue?
No. Well, wow. It was actually the fact that the inference server that TRLX uses for the rollouts was entirely different than the inference server that Megatron wanted us to use. So we needed a way to rapidly...
Yeah, this is why PPO is really hard to scale, because you have to have a generation engine and you want this all to be flexible.
Yeah, so we needed a way to dynamically like keep our compute graph for over through the network, but like just copy the weights like in place to like Triton. And I don't think that we ever came up with a solution to do that very effectively. And I think it actually goes a step further. I don't think the Nemo Align was like what NVIDIA did. I don't think Nemo Align came up with a solution for that either.
Yeah. I mean, this is interesting because I'm not going to say the details on the pod because I'm not allowed. But like Anthropic and these places that have custom RLHF infrastructure have essentially like built their distributed training infrastructure with the idea that the model will need to be generated from at different checkpoints. Mm-hmm. And the model will be served to different endpoints at different checkpoints. So it's just very different than taking DeepSpeed off itself, which is like, this is just about training. Well, it's like these other companies that do this stuff really well have infrastructure for like handling these really messed up cases of like how to generate and update these models.
Yeah. And most approaches that like you, a reasonable person would build off the shelf, like would rely on torch.compile. And you still have the same issue. Like your weights are changing dynamically. It's very, very hard to really even like understand like all of like the little like technical details in torch.compile that have to be accounted for to even make this work. Right. And like, you know, something that we considered at the time was we need to do like an insane amount of rollouts for every gradient step. And we don't want that interface between the rollouts and the training to be Python. We want it to be like Rust or something, because like otherwise the CPU overhead is like mind-boggling. It was like 80% or something crazy. It was like 80% of the entire processing time was just CPU stuff. And like
not so much.
I know. And like there's so many different like infrastructure constraints that like people don't realize when they're just doing like 20 billion parameter PPO, right? The other one I was going back to, right, the value function being separate from the policy network, TRL was very, very gung-ho on, like, keeping them separate. And I think RL for LMs also wanted to keep them separate. And then there was someone from Cornell, I don't remember his name, he was also in the RL for LMs paper. He did a paper like PPO Plus or something. I don't remember what it was.
I mean, all these things are interesting. I mean, there's new libraries coming out still, so it's like, I saw one recently that was called OpenRLHF, and like, it looks good. I think that it's like there's so much institutional like breaking the bonds of past RL that needs to happen. So like this library is like listing that they have the implementation details from like the original like N implementation details of PPO paper, where it's like we've already updated, like Cost has worked on the N implementation details of RLHF paper, which is like the ones that they actually need. But it's like there's so much like baggage by the fact that PPO came out of this control field that everyone expects the tricks that you need from scratch learning from PPO to apply to this fine tuning method. And just like even getting the people to stop using PPO for that, and like DPO is a new thing. Like DPO is something that only is works for preference alignment. People are going to explore in a scientific way that's much fresher. So they're probably going to make more scientific progress because there's not this kind of confusion of what implementation details do we need? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for sure. I think when the end technical details of RLHF, did that come out?
Yeah, it's a blog post.
It's a blog post. When?
Maybe a month ago.
Oh man, I totally missed that. Oh, that's so cool. I'm gonna go read that.
This is for anyone still listening. If you want to know the actual details of RLHF, like go look at all the stuff that Costa Huang has been doing at Hugging Face. Like I was just like reproducing everything and in explicit detail. Mm-hmm. I feel like both of us would benefit from rereading it. So it's like there's some free content to spend.
Costa is like one of the most like meticulous, very attention focused person that I know in the RLHF space. Like if Costa says something works, it's because he's like tried it from every other angle and then tried it from angles that like you didn't even expect, and all of them work.
Yeah, it's great. I think I have a couple like more fun questions of while we wrap up. We could go on with all these technical things forever. What was it like to work at Carper when ChatGPT came out? Because ChatGPT, from a technical perspective, is RLHF is validated as something that is necessary to the future of language models. And you were one of the few people that were working on RLHF beforehand, mm-hmm. which is a huge, like, this is how you end up here. This is awesome. You ride that kind of journey. It's like, what was that like?
I mean, the star count on the repository exploded. I think we went from like,
because TRLX existed before.
It was just insane, and it was we almost weren't positioned. I guess I could be fully honest with you, we almost weren't positioned to entirely ride the hype train. TROX was always designed from the very, very beginning to be like a one-stop shop for enterprises to do ROHF. Like companies that had like 1,000 GPUs and they already have an engineering team and they just don't want, they already use like Megatron Deep Speed or they already use Deep Speed and they just want something that works on their infrastructure. And because we use like Docker images that like were just based off of the Deep Speed, the Megatron Deep Speed Docker images anyways, right? So like those kinds of companies could very, very easily deploy TROX and utilize it in their stack, right?
Yeah.
And the hype that came from ChatGPT, at least initially, was not enterprises. It was like bloggers. It was media.
Yeah, it was like me writing a blog post. You were probably like training big models, and I'm like, hey, how does RLHF work? I need to write this blog post.
Yeah, I'm like you're like training like a 40 billion parameter model, and they're like, hey, can you help me train this like 400 million parameter guy? And I'm like, but I'm so busy.
Okay, so it's primarily a scaling thing. I think is there like, were there any cultural things that you think like being early, like were you bought into RLHF to the same extent ahead of time? Like what got you into RLHF? Like what motivated Carper to exist? And did this, was that kind of consistent?
So I've always been very, very bullish on critiques and revisions in general. So I wrote the first or the second one. I don't actually remember if the super alignment team at OpenAI wrote a paper before me. They may have, but I don't think so. I think ours came out like a month before it.
That always feels good.
Yeah. I wrote one of the first papers on like critiques and revisions, right? And I was very, very bullish on that. But initially, I was only bullish on it for evaluation, right? And I had experimented with PPO a little bit back in 2021 for like this kind of critique and revision stuff. And it was not ready whatsoever. And there was no infrastructure, and TRL was an abandoned library that was very buggy. It didn't work. No shade to Leandro. I love Leandro, but like it was obviously a depreciated library. Like it happens. Yeah. And I think when we tried to do ROHF then, like there was no traction whatsoever. So Alex Havrilla and I think he's working with Meta now. I don't remember.
Yeah, he was an intern at least. He just had an interesting paper on like reasoning and math, which is a whole other conversation for RLHF stuff.
Yeah, so we forked TRL and we just added deep speed support. That's all we wanted to do initially. And then we were going to merge back to TRL because we had no visions of like Carper or anything like that. And we realized to make a framework that people would actually want to use, we had to do a full rewrite of TRL and we had to build things in a way that made sense to an engineer who wanted to deploy RLHF or who wanted to experiment with RLHF at a company or in a lab. Because we were building this from the perspective of, well, we're on the Eleuther AI GPU cluster. How can we best use our infrastructure there?
Publicly said how many GPUs Eleuther has? This is like one of my great mysteries. Is this like a held secret?
I don't think it's a held secret. I don't remember actually. They have some stability GPUs and they have GPUs from elsewhere.
Like they seem to get compute when they need it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not an issue. And I've through Synth Labs, I've been supplying a bit of compute here and there as well. I gave them like a node of like H100s for like a little while for a paper that we were working on with the Pink Elephants paper. But I don't think that like they're not like super short on compute. They're a little short probably. Like everyone's a little short on compute.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're super short on compute. Yeah. But yeah, so we built it with the Eleuther cluster in mind. And because we built it with the Eleuther cluster in mind, you know, we kind of said, well, we can kind of turn this into a thing where like we build the infrastructure that like people can like readily deploy on their clusters and it'll just work for them. And like we can make Carper AI. So we made Carper AI and shortly after like, you know, all the stability stuff started happening, Carper joined Stability and I worked there for a while. And last summer I left to join back with Eleuther because, you know, I long for the days of being an engineer. I love waking up in the morning, writing code, eating a little bit, and then going to sleep.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difference. Like, I spend the time writing because I like to. We've had plenty of discussions where you're like, oh, I should start a blog. And it's like, it comes down to doing what you like to do. And it's like, you're doing great as it is.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's kind of a good place to stop. Where should people find you? What do you want to boost while we sign off here?
So my Twitter is El Castricado. Or you can follow the Synth Labs Twitter. It is, I don't remember what it is off the top of my head.
Do you have any goose announcements?
No goose announcements at the moment, unfortunately. It's synth_labs on Twitter is that Twitter account. And then El Castricado is my personal Twitter account. And I'm always open to collaborators, especially now with Synth Labs. So we're always happy to chat with and talk to new people about like interesting research directions. And yeah, just reach out and we can get something going, I guess.
Yeah, I love the URL in the show notes. It's synthlabs.ai. I've found that it's like because synthetic data is so hot and it's so new, it's like some of these URLs are just hard to find. It's like, we don't have to go into the whole rant about naming and stuff, but it's like most of the people that search for my Substack, well, if you don't put the S, if you don't write interconnects, you get a different Substack first. So it's like, okay, we're all in this together for anyone founding a startup or a blog and struggling with naming. Please send us questions about RLA, Jeff. If you liked this, Lewis could come back. I'm trying to start an in-person thing and get some gear so when I'm at a conference or whatever, we can bring researchers on and kind of remove some of the Zoom aspects that we're all stuck in so much of the time. So thanks, Lewis, for putting some of the things we talked about a lot like onto the semi-record. I don't think people listen and read. So
of course.
This is good. I think a lot of researchers are going to dig into this. There's so many different things that we talked about. It's very high information density chat here. But it was a good time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.